Good afternoon. How are you? Meditation going well? Have another, not quite 2 days. Okay, well, have a few new questions and a few old questions.
Are there pranic correlations to agitation and dullness that we could use as a tool, as a way of noticing them, other than the ways we've talked about? I don't usually push for the person that wrote the question to identify themselves, but in this particular case, it's up to you, but could you explain a little bit more what you're asking?
I noticed that at certain points with subtle dullness especially, I could feel a sort of energetic block at a certain place in my body. If I brought my attention there briefly, it would solve the problem.
That's a very good thing for you to know about yourself and take advantage of. And it perhaps may be something that other people can make use of as well. It assumes that you're already fairly sensitive to the movement of the energy in your body and can sense when there's a block, right? So if you can do that, then you might try that and find that it's helpful. Is there any more to the question, or is that?
No, it's kind of the reason I asked because I thought it might have been because I was moving my attention there, and you might say, well, actually, it's just because you put your attention there, so don't bother doing that. So I just wanted to make sure.
It could be that, it could possibly be that you moved your attention there. But if it brings you out of the dullness and the dullness stays away, then do it. And it really did, yeah. That's what's most important. After all, that's the instruction, right? Recognize the dullness and do whatever necessary to bring yourself out of it. Okay. Okay. Is it cheating to drink stimulant drinks to help ward off dullness in meditation? There are a lot of people I know who, for example, do not meditate in the morning without first having a cup of coffee. And there's also mate tea, which is said to promote calm alertness. That's it. You don't need to meditate. You just drink mate tea. Couldn't this be helpful to cope with dullness in the afternoon? Or should one learn to overcome dullness without such aid? What do you think? Is it cheating? What's cheating anyway?
You could say the cushions are cheating.
What's that?
You could say the cushions are cheating. It's like I can't.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Is it cheating to sit on cushions, or should we sit on the bare ground and look through our pain? You wouldn't want to become dependent on anything at all. And really, you think about it as you want to move beyond every kind of dependency. Ultimately, you don't want to have to depend on sitting down in meditation posture and closing your eyes, right? You'd like to be able to have access to clarity and stability without doing that. So that's the problem with stimulants, is that you come to rely on them. And the other problem, the more serious problem, is if you think of dullness in terms of something to overcome at any cost rather than something to welcome when it comes, because it's going to give you the opportunity to train your mind not to go into dullness so that you're not going to have dullness as a problem in general. In your life in general, and your meditation in general, that you're going to learn to be able to shift your mind to a state of higher mental clarity. So the most important thing that I would say with regard to this particular question is, don't confuse getting rid of the dullness with training your mind not to become dull, because they're two totally different things. On the other hand, there are times when if you find it helpful to have a coffee or a tea with caffeine in it before the afternoon meditation, that's fine. That's not a problem. But as I say, you shouldn't become dependent upon it. You're looking for the day when that you don't need that sort of support at all. I know people who do not meditate in the morning without first having a cup of coffee. If you're used to drinking coffee, then basically you need that cup of coffee to be normal. If you're not used to drinking coffee, then that cup of coffee is going to give you an unusual boost that you're not due to, and are used to, and you don't need that. Like, I'm going to start walking around on a crutch now in case I go lame. But if your physiology is acclimatized to a certain dose of caffeine in the morning, which many, many people are in the world today, I would encourage you to consider whether that's the way you always want to be or not. But if that's the way you are, that's the way you are, and don't feel like there's anything wrong with it at all, because you'll have a much more difficult meditation without that usual cup of coffee. So go ahead and do it. Is that clear? That's my sort of pseudo-liberal. Not quite if it feels good to it, but. Just keep your eye on the long-term goal. And whatever you do in the short term, you evaluate what it's going to do for you in terms of achieving that long-term goal. And then do what works. Okay. Often when meditating, this collection of mental formations, excellent, I like that, experiences the hands melting into each other as if they are disappearing. The feet as well fade into the floor with the pressure. On some days, it seems to spread throughout the body, so the sense of groundedness and support from whatever is under me is clearly there. With continued attention to the breath and not sinking, the body seems to expand. Is this something desired? Well, this is something that is normal, and it's one of those positive indicators of that you're making good progress in your practice. These alterations in your bodily perception, particularly where normal sensations disappear to be replaced by those that are really highly conducive to you sitting perfectly still and comfortably for long periods of time. Other than the somewhat unusual and startling aspect of realizing that your hands aren't there anymore, or that your legs and feet aren't there anymore, which are, when it happens, you can't help but be curious, right? Wow, what's happening? And so you're going to naturally want to explore a little bit, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. But it's nothing to get attached to. There's nothing special about it. Some people will have those kinds of things, and other people won't. They'll have different kinds of experiences that are associated with. Basically, they're indicators of good concentration and of your mind beginning to unify to the extent that particularly the sensory minds, they're usually feeding all this sensory information into consciousness about the state, position of your body, the aches and pains here and there, but changing the way that they function. And in the process of that changing, they produce unusual sensation, they end up leaving you with a very pleasant experience of the body that's quite unusual but extremely conducive to practice, and that's called physical pliancy. And so that is a very good thing. And so these things are indicators of the development of physical pliancy. So in that regard, they're very good and positive, but they're not something to be attached to be desired. If you're going to desire something, desire the achievement of full physical pliancy, not the indicators that occur along the way. And I don't know if the person that is meant desired in quite that term. They're positive, yes. But they're not something to be attached to, sought after, worried about whether they happen or not. Just let it happen. Once you've gotten over the initial curiosity and fascination about such an unusual experience, then just let go of it and continue practicing as usual. Okay? Other questions on that? In the 10 stages of meditation reading, you mentioned supplemental practices that help in a householder's meditation practice that you will discuss in the appendices. What are those supplemental practices? That handout was an excerpt from an earlier version of part of earlier, yeah, a version of a part of the book. So I could talk a little bit about those practices, the things that you can do in your daily life. One of them is just doing a little mini meditation, following your breath in all of those circumstances where you have the opportunity to. So you might, for example, be waiting in a checkout line and you can start following your breath. You remain aware of everything around you so that you know when it's your turn to step up to the register. But at the same time, you're stabilizing your attention on your breath. And so you can do a little mini meditations like that, all kinds of situations. Sitting, waiting for a light to change in a car. That's one of the sorts of things you can do. Perhaps the most valuable thing, really important thing, because it's what you really want to be able to do as a result of the sitting and walking meditation, is to maintain mindful awareness in daily life as much as possible. And of course, there are situations that require so much of your attention, they require you to be engaged and active to a degree that they're not conducive to that. But then there are a lot of other things that you can do with a very total kind of mindfulness. An example is a trip to the photocopier, right? Every single movement doesn't require, well, if it requires some thought, do the thinking first, you know, back to front. I'm going to talk to you. But once you've done that, then the rest of the process can be like a total mini meditation, right? When you find yourself sitting in a meeting and feeling a bit irritated at that person who always feels like the purpose of these meetings are his or her opportunity to express their views on everything, examine your mind and your reactions to it, right? Including how it makes you feel physically. Become sensitive to that and tune in on that so that you see the kind of reactions that you're having. And then look at those reactions from the point of view of your Dharma understanding. I'm developing aversion. If I indulge myself in this aversion right now, I'm going to just be that much more prone to aversion in the future in similar situations. I wonder what the alternative is. Let me look at this person and listen to this person from a place of patience and compassion instead of where I was. Things like that. So I actually haven't written that appendix yet. In the latest version of the table of contents that I sent to the editor, that appendix disappeared. But I thought, this is getting pretty long. We got a lot of, you know, five appendices. Do you need a fifth one, sort of thing? And so I thought, yeah, well, maybe people don't need these kinds of things. I don't know. What do you think?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But not if it's going to take longer.
What's that?
But not if it's
going to
take longer.
Okay. I'll just whip something off. Yeah. Okay. That can be the second edition.
I have a rather boring job, and I have for a long time been doing what you just said, so it really reinforces me to hear you say that, a good portion of my job is pretty much do it. You know, like I push a lawnmower like for 6-7 hours a day quite often, and that I can relate to my breath, and I can get way away from being a lawnmower.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I wanted to ask that, but I wasn't sure how. So.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. I'm glad that somebody asked on your behalf. Yeah. In some ways, you know, if you think in terms of making your life into a Dharma practice, and then you look at what kind of work you could do. Of course, there's some things that are obvious. Many people who decide to take that approach end up going into service professions, nursing, things like that, that allow them to do a lot of serving, helping, caring kinds of activities, and that's very, very good. That is a good way to make making your living into a part of your Dharma practice. But don't neglect those jobs like the one that Mark just mentioned. They're tremendous opportunities. You can basically meditate 8 hours a day and get paid for it in some job. And from our ordinary point of view of, well, I want a job that's stimulating and feels important, you know, I'm always proud to tell somebody how important my job is and have them say, oh boy, you must be really smart to be able to do that. You might be willing to give that up in exchange for something that would allow you to get paid for basically practicing meditation all day. So. I try to maintain awareness as I fall asleep. First, I notice the delicious tiredness as moments of consciousness start to become unconscious. When about 25% of moments of consciousness become unconscious, I lose my awareness and fall asleep. Is there a trick for staying aware through falling asleep? Really, the trick is to just keep doing it. And, it's very interesting that the person writing this felt comfortable sort of quantifying but that is the sort of thing that you experience. You notice both your awareness and your attention. You notice how your attention starts to become disjointed, and there's these shifts, and to the degree that you're aware of it, you're aware that you're in the middle of a thought and you just completely lost it. And some other thought came along, take its place. And then the awareness of itself, you'll observe the awareness itself begins to fade. More and more awareness fades. And to do this repeatedly, it becomes familiar. And it's like you come to the place where you have not necessarily a verbal thought, but you have a recognition that, okay, from where I am now, I'm probably going to be asleep in just another few seconds. As that goes on, what will happen is you'll start to have moments of awareness when you're dreaming. You'll just be fleeting, but, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, I guess I did. It sort of picks up where you left off. The last thought was, oh, I'm probably going to be sleeping another few seconds. And then the next thought that seems to come up in almost the same train is, oh, I did fall asleep, now I'm dreaming. And there comes to be more and more of that kind of awareness, especially if you're in retreat, you're being mindful all day long. Then you can get to that place where it's a very dim kind of awareness, but nevertheless, you're kind of aware of yourself going through all the stages of dreaming and deep sleep, and then you find yourself waking up, and there's this awareness that that could be verbalized as, oh yeah, I'm probably going to be awake in a few minutes. I feel myself coming out of it. And then you do. And in a retreat situation, I don't know whether you're noticing it, if you get enough sleep, if you've actually got enough sleep, that point when you get enough sleep, it's like you just wake up and you're there and you're fully awake. And you look at the clock and it first sits at 6:30, but it's only 4:15, and it's like, what the heck, no point in going back to sleep. As you know, you're just totally awake. Yeah.
Is there an advantage to lucid dreaming?
And there's a lot of things that you can learn about lucid, learn from lucid dreaming. But if you cultivate that kind of awareness in the dream state, then you're naturally going to have a much greater awareness the rest of the time as well. So it's another way of increasing. It's another way of making sustained awareness a habit. Yeah.
What about when you feel like too aware to fall asleep?
You feel like your mind's too alert.
You can just experience every thought and like the trails of every thought. And like, all right, I just want to go to bed. And turn it off.
Yeah. Well, what I do is I go to bed and I focus both my attention and my awareness on the sensations of my body. And that serves the purpose of calming down the activity of my mind. And it's very restful. So even if I don't fall asleep for an hour, I'm still having a very restful and pleasant experience. You know, I'm just totally aware of the comfortable sensation of laying in the bed, or, you know, just the right temperature, part of your body is a little warmer, part is a little cooler, the contrast is wonderful, isn't this delicious, right? Yeah, you know, you've been there. So you can just be there fully consciously and enjoy that. So you don't fall asleep, but you have an hour of delightful experience, nevertheless. You know, and you're watching your mind, you notice that, wow, I was so comfortable a minute ago that now I'm starting to feel this like achiness in my shoulder and this urge to move, to leave it, you know. And so you just watch that whole process. And when I'm meditating, I don't move, but when I'm going to sleep, I take the sort of viewpoint of, wow, I'm going to watch and see how long it takes before my body goes ahead and moves on its own. And it will. But yeah, in terms of practices that you can do in your daily life, meditating as you go to sleep and meditating as you wake up. For meditating as you wake up, you set the intention, and then if you always do that, you start, as you begin entering those lighter states of sleep, you start to have a little bit of recollection of the intention to be mindful as you wake up. And so just continuing in that way, then you get to have the opposite experience. When you're going to sleep at night, you're observing the mind's descent into dullness. Right? Which also will help you recognize dullness when you're meditating. When you're waking up in the morning, you get to observe the way your mind sort of resumes its normal, fully active state of functioning. Which is also, I mean, absolutely anything you watch in your mind is going to teach you something. In my experience, increase the overall fascination. I have a mind fetish.
As far as the energy level between the cerebral cortex and the particular activating system going at a certain rate for waking consciousness and mm-hmm. slows down as we go into dullness, which could lead to nodding off. If it's slow enough that out of habit we say, oh, we don't say consciously, but we fall asleep. Are those rates of energy flux equatable to the different brainwave states like alpha, beta, theta, and delta?
Well, they definitely show up on an EEG, you know, and somebody who is used to looking at a sleeper's EEG can, you know, they know exactly when they're going to sleep, and they can see, okay, they're starting to wake up, and you see those shifts and changes. It's, I'm trying to remember, this isn't something I have a lot of familiarity with, but it's the very slow wave patterns are very dominant when you're asleep, the delta waves and so forth. And then as you start moving into wakefulness, the shorter frequencies, the shorter wave frequencies start to show more bursts of activity. So, let's see. Okay. Here's another one. Okay, an interesting one. Says, you may, if it's convenient, we have 4 minutes left, want to specify what you mean by Maha Mudra meditation. Michael Roach created this study grid with select elements from each school of Tibetan Buddhism around their select views on emptiness. Oddly enough, he called that Maha Mudra and taught analytical meditation based on that grid. Okay, and then I guess these are the questions that you use in the analytical meditation. Is my mind, contents of mind, permanent, impermanent? Am I in control or not? And so forth. I believe you mean something quite different when you say Maha Mudra, meditation on the mind. Yes, I mean something very, very different. Not an analytical meditation at all. Maha Mudra is sort of the principal practice in the Kagyu tradition, and it directly corresponds to the Dzogchen meditation in the Nyingma. No matter how the difference between them is that Maha Mudra is a little bit more structured, a little more elaborated in terms of the instructions, and the Dzogchen is you receive the pointing out instructions. Basically, the teacher shows you what you're looking for. You know how, and if I do a guided meditation with you, that I'm able to guide you into the experience, and you have to work harder on your own to repeat that. That's the same thing. This is what the Dzogchen master does, is points out to you where you want to go, and it's up to you to sit there and find your own way. So Dzogchen and Maha Mudra, they're both meditations on the mind itself, and they are not analytical. They're meditations. They're very sophisticated meditations because you've already had to. If you were to go to the library and get one of the texts on Maha Mudra, there's some fabulous texts on Maha Mudra, by the way. Well, you'll find you'll get a volume that's maybe 2 inches, more than 2 inches thick. And then you go through it, and you'll find that more than half of the volume is samatha, is developing samatha. That's the starting point for the Maha Mudra practice. Because you have to have those skills to put your mind in a place where you're observing the mind itself. And that is it's a very simple description of meditation, but it's also totally accurate. That's really all that it's about, is you observe the mind. There are questions. Usually, in a traditional approach, the teacher is going to ask the student, you know, the meditation interviews, and their instructions and their questions. So the teacher will say, the beginning instructions are, go practice and come back and tell me what color the mind is, what shape it is, how big it is, does it move, does it stay in the same place, things like that. And it's based on answers to those questions that the teacher knows that, in fact, the student has understood the instruction, is in fact getting into the mode of looking at their own mind, seeing their own mind. Then you need to distinguish between the mind that is at rest and the mind that is active or in motion. Basically, the difference is there are those periods where there's very little happening in your mind. And then when the mind moves, it's producing an object of consciousness, a thought, an emotion, whatever. In the meditation on the mind, you let it do its thing. And so you let it alternate between these more and less active states and study and compare them. And then the questions that follow are things that ask you what you've been able to discern about the nature of the objects of consciousness as they arise. And on the one hand, we study and talk about the nature of objects of consciousness as we have last night, things like that. But the teacher is not looking for an intellectual answer that is the result of analytical thinking at all. Looking for an answer that comes from having directly seen the nature of the objects of consciousness as they arrive. And so on, and then compare the nature, compare mind to the objects. And it's a very beautiful, elegant system. But it is very much a meditation. It's not an analytical process. So this is, I'm glad that came up, because I just assumed, because I've heard a number of you, and even in the meditation interviews, say, well, sometimes I do Mahamudra, and blah. And I kind of assumed that we were talking about the same thing. And maybe in some cases we were. Yeah.
What color is the mind?
Well, meditate on mine and you tell me what color it is.
It's a deep, dark, beautiful, luminous blue.
That's one of its colors, yeah. That was a good question, a little bit illuminating, I think, for all of us.
What would be a better description of that analytical progression through the different schools' view of...
We're looking at the different schools. I'm describing it as an analytical meditation or a contemplation. I mean, definitely, I assume what you're doing is you're looking at the approaches of the different schools, because by looking at it expressed in different ways, you get a clearer understanding than if you look at just one way of describing it. Is that the purpose of it?
That and as a progression.
And the which?
And as a progression, like a progressive way of looking at different categories.
If we set up to study a take on emptiness. And it's set up so that you start with what this specific point of view considers a lower thought on emptiness up to what it presents as the highest thought on it.
Okay, I got you. Okay, this is why their view isn't as good as ours. That's why their view isn't as good as ours. That kind of thing.
Well, it's not only that of Chandasa, but it goes through the different aspects too. So it's like contemplating on changing, contemplating on no self. I mean, as you contemplate separately, no impermanence, no self nature, no essential essences and things. As separate aspects.
Based on different sets of assumptions?
No, you just kind of look at them separately. So first you work on looking at no impermanence, for example, and then you would work on just seeing that things don't have unity or that they are different from different perspectives and things like that. Mm-hmm. So you it's like you're looking at the different aspects, but separately, but then progressively. In addition to what they said.
In addition to. Okay, I was thinking what you were saying as being expression. Yeah.
Okay, so to me that makes a lot of sense. I mean, if you examine impermanence, this is what I'm hearing you say, you can see what impermanence has to tell you about emptiness. And then if you examine dependent arising, you can see what dependent arising has to tell you about. And then, as we did last night, we look at the five aggregates and see what it has to tell us about. That sort of thing?
Yeah, but it's marketed as that impermanence is a flavor of emptiness, but not the real emptiness. So that's the kind of that's the marketing strategy for it. Let's start looking at impermanence first, not as the real emptiness, but as the first level to get you towards understanding it.
Okay.
And then progressively.
Yeah, it sounds like it might be a good system, although it could stand to drop that bias, I think.
I think of it as like a ski progression. Like if you're going to put someone on skis for the first day, you put them on a green hill, and you get them to just stand there in their skis, and then lean forward and snowplow, make a pizza wedge, and you know, and it's like a gradual developmental progression through. I mean, personally, never had it presented as a these guys have a lesser view than these guys. I mean, I've heard that, but I never felt value.
Right.
I appreciated one idea dovetailing beautifully into the next within the internal context of the meditative experience.
Yeah, and that I see as being a really valuable aspect. If you can just drop the other part of it, because certainly it's like if you approach it from these different directions, each direction gives you a different perspective, and it deepens your understanding by investigating it from these different points of view. Yeah, and then that's very enriching. That's very, very valuable to do. So, you do this in most Buddhist traditions. The one I'm familiar with, you would use all the different doctrines, the basic doctrines that the Buddha himself taught, like the ones that I mentioned, you know, dependent arising and impermanence and no self and so forth. Each of them is showing you one facet, one aspect of emptiness. Because actually, just a little historical note, the idea of emptiness, that's actually how it arose, is as a term to describe the synthesis, like, you know, basically the observation was that when we achieve some realization of impermanence, and when we realize when we achieve some realization of no self, and when we achieve some deeper realization of the implications of dependent origination, they're all leading us to the same thing. And then emptiness was a label that was created by the way, I like to say that, you know, there are three characteristics and there are four of them. The three characteristics are impermanence, no self, and suffering. And we have to throw emptiness in because emptiness really shows you how they overlap. So it's the point of convergence of them. So that as an analytical meditation, that is a good and traditional practice. I kind of see it's being called Mahamudra, I suppose, because it is a meditation on emptiness.
I think it's just referring to the what does the Great Seal mean, rather than specifically the meditative.
So it's not really the meditation from the Kagyu. It's something quite different, but nevertheless, it shares the same name because of that commonality. Yeah. Okay.
You might mention the name of the book on Mahamudra, written by the Kagyu.
Well, if you really would like to get into Mahamudra, there are some very good books on it. The absolute best is I have a terrible memory for names. It's the I believe it's the fifth karmapa, and it's the ocean of definitive meaning is the English translation of it. It's been translated into English twice, once by some people in the U.S., and they won't let anybody buy it unless it gets, unless the purchaser gets approved through the teacher in their lineage. But there is an actually much better translation of it available in Germany, translated into English. It was translated into German and then into English, and it's actually a much better translation. Which, if you want to get interested in, seriously interested in the practice of Mahamudra, I would recommend getting that book. It's the clearest text on it. But there are a number that you could, if you just Google, or if you just go to Amazon and search Mahamudra, you'll find a book by Brown, which is very good. And then there are some other books by a Tibetan Lama. I wish I could tell. He's one of my favorite all-time people. Yeah, I can't remember his name. But he has a whole series of books on Mahamudra. And they're mostly transcriptions and collations of talks he's given. So the quality of books varies enormously. But that's a fabulous source as well.
Is Brown the publisher or the author?
Oh, Brown is the name of the author. I think that's it. The bill already ran. Oh my goodness, the bill already ran 9 minutes. Okay.
Can I switch it up? Just two quick questions. Does it make sense to study Mahamudra before one has shamatha? And then if by reading, does it make sense? If you enjoy the pointing out method, it seems like it would be better at best to have a teacher. Is there anything kind of, is there any spoilers if you're looking at the, or is that, I'm just kind of curious about
that.
A teacher and engaged in that process versus what can you actually gain from a book in that?
Okay, that is a very good question. And we're speaking of Mahamudra in the sense of the cognitive senses of meditation, not what you're already familiar with. If you've made significant progress in samatha, you're going to be in a position to be able to understand these writings on Mahamudra, and you can begin the practice. But two things: you have to have some progress in samatha to actually be able to do the practice. It's just the untrained mind just won't behave well enough to give you an effective practice. By the time you get to stage 7 or 8, it's a perfect practice. It'd be a wonderful practice for you to do. You can start playing around with it. You know, if you have we usually do, even when you're at stage 4 or 5, you have some meditation experiences, which are more at the level of 6 or 7 or 8. And for that reason, there's absolutely nothing wrong with acquainting yourself with the practice and experimenting with it a bit, even before you're really at a point that you can do it with full effectiveness. But by the time you get, by the time you've established a solid basis in samatha, by the time you're up to stage 8 or 9, you will be able to read these texts from 1,000 years ago, and you'll say, yes, right. And you can go, and what it does is it gives you, it lays out for you, this is the Karmapu's description. He says, this is what the teacher says to the student. And then the student goes and so you basically got the teacher there. So you read that, and you go and you do the practice, and you look to see what color and shape and so forth. And then when you feel like you're ready, you can go ahead and read the next section and see what the teacher says about your answers. So it's best. All these things are best if you have access to a teacher. But the practice that you're doing now will give you a foundation
that you can do almost any meditation practice in the world, and you'll be able to do it fairly well without having to rely heavily on the availability of a teacher, because you'll know so much about your mind, and you'll know how it works, so that when you look at something like Maha Mudra or Zen or something like that, you know, there's a really strong recognition, okay, I've never done that before, but I can see exactly what's being intended here. Which is why I consider this such an important foundation. Okay, now you only have 30 minutes left. So, thank you. I'll see you later.